of cream, red roses too.
This is Ed Cohen, editor and publisher of GlobalBusinessNews.net, and your host today on GlobalRadioTalkShow.com, coming to you today from San Diego and San Francisco. Our special guest today is Mr. Brandon Meyer from Meyer Law Group. Let's welcome Brandon.
Hello, Ed. Thanks for having me today.
So there is so much going on in the global mobility side of things, not just immigration, but employment-wise. Let's just jump in for a second. First, tell us about yourself. How long have you been a lawyer specializing in immigration issues?
Thanks, Ed. I've been in the immigration law industry for approximately 18 years now, and Meyer Law Group has been on its own for the last 5 years. And currently we have offices in beautiful San Diego, which I know you know very well, Ed, San Francisco, and also Seattle, Washington.
Okay, so now tell us, as an attorney in immigration, a couple of the challenges and opportunities for global mobility in the coming year.
Well, Ed, global mobility in the coming year is going to be very challenging. It's going to be very busy and very fast-paced.
Now, does this mean that there's no congressional change happening in an election year?
I would agree. There's always so-called comprehensive immigration reform measures that are always floated. But, you know, there is a presidential election that's coming right around the corner. It's, you know, the campaign season's already started. Both sides, Democrats and Republicans, they're not only polarized on the immigration issue in general, but they're actually polarized within their own caucuses. And so, you know, certain Republicans would like, you know, what we would call favorable business immigration reforms, which Democrats are hostile to. On the Democratic side, they would like to see, you know, immigration reform that helps the undocumented, which is a red line for many Republicans. So you add it all up, and all we see is stalemate until the next president takes office in January 2017 and possibly beyond.
Now, let's talk about changes in the law. From President Obama's executive action was kind of a high-handed thing for sure, but it seems like it freed up a bunch of people to go to work and made some other changes. Now, you know more about this than me. Give us a quick overview, please.
Sure. So approximately 1 year ago, President Obama went on the television and announced a so-called executive action that was – he spent most of his time talking about how his executive action would help the undocumented. But what was not really discussed in his speech, but because it was more technical and, frankly, fewer people cared about, was reforms, certain tweaks to existing laws that actually, in my opinion, have more tangible benefit to the business community. And so for years, the U.S. was not a very attractive place for many expatriates to go to because we had the problem of the trailing spouse, i.e. many trailing spouses were unable to obtain work authorization by virtue of the principal moving to the United States and having work. In certain circumstances and situations, President Obama's executive action actually changed that, starting first this past spring, allowing certain qualifying individuals who are on what's known as H-4 visas, you know, dependent of H-1Bs, which is the most common work visa available, to actually obtain their own independent work authorization. That was the first big change. The second big change came this past September, when it was phrased in the terminology of, oh, the U.S. is going to modernize the way it allocates immigrant visas. So what that was really a code for was allowing certain individuals that are subject to, you know, crushing backlogs to obtain their permanent residence or green cards to essentially file shadow, mirror, parallel, whatever you want to call it, green card applications. They won't get actual green cards for 10, 15, 20 years. But what it allows people to do is also obtain independent work authorization and no longer be tied to their current employer after 180 days. Huge, huge benefits and challenges to the individuals and the companies that are impacted by this executive action change.
Now, this means that people are going to quit jobs or move on?
Absolutely. So And we're already seeing this in our practice. There's a, where you can see that people are counting down 180 days. And why I mentioned 180 days, in the Clinton administration, there was the what was known as the American Competitiveness in the 21st Century Act of 2000, shorthand AC-21. And so what AC-21 allowed, among other things, was if someone's green card application was pending at U.S. Immigration for more than 180 days, they could change jobs and not lose their green card process. And so I look at this, and you know that's been in effect for 15-plus years now, but this so-called tweak to the visa bulletin to allow a whole new class of applicants to apply really opens up, I call it the great talent churn of 2016. Because come March, come April, May, June 2016, when the 180-day mark kicks in for a lot of these new applicants, one of the first things they're going to do is tell their employee goodbye and go across the street and work for their competitor. So that's the challenge. Companies are going to see lots of talent leave, but it's also an opportunity. For every one of a company's employees that leaves, that means someone else's employees want to leave. So it is liberating. And so 2016 for the global mobility professional is going to be a very busy and interesting year.
So that means job security for the relocation managers.
It does. And it also means for the relocation management companies out there, it means new sources of revenue as well. Because if people are able to move around, they will. And so the whole subset of our industry will be in for a very busy 2016.
So now what does this do about the spouses now of H-1Bs have trailing spouses who can now work, right?
Yes, there is some eligibility criteria attached to that. So if the H-1B spouse is far enough along in the green card process, but also for a variety of reasons, unable to actually obtain the permanent residence, as long as those eligibility criteria are met, the trailing H-4 spouse can request independent work authorization. It also works in both ways. What we're seeing, too, is you know there's a lot of dual H-1B households here. So we're getting calls from H-1Bs and saying, hey, I know you've never heard this before and the entire time you've been doing this, but I want to become an H-4. And why do they want to become an H-4? Because, again, with the work authorization that comes with H-4 status, they're not tied to their employer. They're once again liberated.
What does this have to do with the EB-5?
EB-5, that is the one area I think we'll see legislative change on. And the reason why that is a large section of the EB-5 law actually expired September 30th, 2015. Now, as a part of a continuing budgetary resolution, the current program has been extended until December 11th, 2015. So we have another 7 weeks of the old law. However, there's many competing proposals to reform or change or modify EB-5, the EB-5 Immigrant Investor Program. The Immigrant Investor Program has been around since 1990, and the core of the program has not changed in the last 25 years. So there's many competing legislative proposals to essentially modernize, hopefully improve, and hopefully make more efficient the Immigrant Investor EB-5 program. So there will be, as I tell clients, there will be a new law at some point in the next 3 to 6 months. We don't know what it is, but we will see some changes that will take some time to digest.
Well, let's go back to the STEM, S-T-E-M, science, technology, engineering, mathematics,
yes.
Not only professionals, but companies moving around, whether it's from China or India or some other place. This is a big growth area, and has been, of course. I know it is,
yes,
here in San Diego. What do,
mm-hmm,
you see about that?
That's an interesting you bring that up. So in the dying embers of the Bush administration, USCIS decided to allow individuals who graduate from so-called STEM fields from U.S. institutions to have up to 29 months of postgraduate work authorization before they have to get an H-1B or any type of work visa. Prior to that, it was 12 months. And so that has been a huge benefit to companies, and maybe we'll talk about this later, that if someone was eligible for up to 29 months, it wasn't such a big deal if they couldn't get an H-1B the first or even the second time of applying because they were still allowed to be employed. However, a few months ago, a group actually challenged a group of U.S. technology workers filed lawsuit against U.S. Immigration saying that the Bush administration did not follow proper rulemaking procedures when they enacted that change back in 2008. And so a federal judge actually agreed with the technology workers. But instead of just throwing out the 29 months of STEM work authorization, which would have thrown the technology industry and the lives of many people into real chaos, the federal judge said, okay, U.S. Immigration, you have until February 12th to correct the deficiencies in the Bush administration's rulemaking process. And so yesterday, USCIS released the proposed new rule for STEM work authorization, which it gives some and takes some away. In the giving, instead of, it actually will extend, if it's adopted in its current form, it'll extend the work authorization up to 36 months from the 29 months. But in taking away, the company has to attest that they're not adversely affecting, laying off, furloughing, et cetera, existing U.S. workers. My personal prediction is that the rule will be enacted pretty much in its current proposed form. And I also think this will be a huge benefit until there's reform or additional H-1B cap numbers, which I don't foresee on the horizon at all.
So all of what we're talking about here is very, very technical and legalistic. So I ask you as an attorney, a practicing attorney for many years, why would companies, meaning employers, why would the corporations choose to use a non-lawyer to handle all this technical stuff? I'm not giving you a softball pitch here, but you know, there's so many paper pushers out there that call themselves immigration experts, but it sounds so legalistic and technical, it's like scary almost. So comment on that.
It is. You know, fortunately, we don't see too much of what's known as the unauthorized practice of law in the business immigration side. It's a huge problem on the family immigration side, huge problem in San Diego, huge problem in Los Angeles, San Francisco, the big cities. And on the family-based side, it's because people rely on word of mouth within their immigrant communities. And so they say, oh, you know, the person down the street can help you. And the person down the street, maybe they create the impression that they're an attorney when they're really not. And clients will sign up with them because it seems like a low-cost, trusted option within the community. But in many instances, if not most, it's usually deleterious to that person's ability to stay in the U.S. and their family situation. And it's very sad. On the business side, fortunately, we don't see too much of it. But when we do, it's usually with companies that, you're right, Ed, I mean, this is highly technical and legalistic, but not all companies. They just see it as, oh, we just want to get someone here. These lawyers are fleecing us. We can do this ourselves. And so there'll be about a dozen times a year where usually someone, you know, who drew the short straw in-house at a company tries to do work visas on their own, and then it usually turns out badly, and they have to come to an attorney to see if they can fix it. Many times the fix is too little, too late. No one's happy with it, but on the company side, yeah, it's lack of respect for the process and the desire to save a few dollars, which always costs more in the long run.
Let's move on and talk about international, overseas, well, I guess here too, but in Europe and elsewhere, there's something called mobility protectionism, right?
Absolutely. We're seeing just today the Canadian government announced that they're tightening up their application procedures for American and Mexican workers who want to go to Canada under the North American Free Trade Agreement. This requires individuals to essentially apply online before they – you used to be – you could basically apply on the spot and be admitted on the spot, given your NAFTA work visa, and come into the U.S. Well, the Canadian government putting a roadblock or hurdle in front of that by requiring people to apply online through their government portal before attempting to come to Canada.
So there's just been an election in Canada with a new administration coming in. Is that going to change things?
I really doubt it. Canada, for a long time, has been evaluating its all of its immigration programs across the board. For instance, about 2 years ago, Canada actually shut down its federal EB-5 immigrant investor program equivalent. Then it tightened up companies' ability to transfer managers and executives from overseas subsidiaries into Canada. So to me, this is almost the next logical step in Canada becoming I don't want to say hostile, but, you know, because Canada's had one of the most liberal and friendly immigration regimes for the last 50 years. I mean, let's face it, Canada is a sparsely populated country, and immigration was a way to populate it. But now Canada is starting to view what they feel are the limits of this open liberal policy. And if Canada's doing it, then it makes it easier for the UK to do it, which is, you know, UK has been tightening the screws around the edges for about the last 5 years, and I see no relief on the horizon for the UK. Likewise, one of the most mobility-friendly job markets was Singapore. Same thing, Singapore is tightening up. If you're a company, you want to bring in immigrant labor, then you now have to advertise a job on a Government of Singapore website. So can companies climb over these hurdles? Absolutely. But does it take longer to do so? Yes. Could more go wrong? Yes. Does it raise transaction costs to get it done? Absolutely. And we're seeing this across the board outside the U.S.
Wall Street Journal and some other resources have made a big deal about expats giving up American citizenship. What's that about?
Yes. It's interesting because, as we know, that and the presidential campaign that we're seeing on the Democratic side and surprisingly on the Republican side is let's tax more, 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 and greater. And then you add that to the fact that the United States is the only government in the world that taxes its citizens on worldwide income, then it makes it attractive for people that have no real ties to the U.S. except for the fact they're citizens that are working overseas to try to avoid this oppressive tax regime in the United States. And the best way to do that is an attempt to renounce their U.S. citizenship. It's not easy to do because the individual has to go to a U.S. consulate abroad and submit to an interview. And the bias of the consular officer is you must be doing this because you're trying to cheat the U.S. government out of its fair share of your income. So it can be done. It's very difficult. It is on the upswing. Part of it also has to do with the difficulty that U.S. citizens working abroad have in maintaining bank accounts. It's just easier to give up your U.S. citizenship than have to have the hassle of paying Uncle Sam everything you earn and not being able to maintain bank accounts in Switzerland or the U.K. because those banks find the reporting requirements imposed on them by the U.S. government and the U.S. Treasury to be too strict.
So just sum up about top tax traps for assignees that are coming into the U.S.
Well, I think the main trap that we see, we'll take the current mayor of London. Boris Johnson was born in the United States through no fault of his own. He was born in the United States. I believe his parents were British diplomats at the UN in New York. Well, the fact that Boris's mother gave birth to him here made Boris a U.S. citizen, whether he wanted to be or not. And he's actually subsequently renounced his U.S. citizenship. Why? Because he got a very large back tax bill from the U.S. government saying, oh, Boris, we noticed that you've been doing this, this, and this, and we want our share of your income for the past 20 years. And so that's an issue we see increasingly. So expats are on assignment in the U.S. They have children here in the U.S. That renders them U.S. citizens, whether they want to be or feel like it. The children go back, U.K., Switzerland, wherever, overseas, start their lives. Now, 30-odd years later, their company is sending them to the U.S. as an expat. and most likely they're unaware that they've had a income reporting requirement since birth. And so that makes it very difficult for people to basically get a back tax bill stretching back however far. So that, to me, that's the major tax trap that we're seeing right now for expats coming to the U.S.
Our special guest has been Brandon Meyer, Meyer Law Group, that's M-E-Y-E-R, MeyerLawGroup.us. Meyer Law Group offers the full range of business and family-based immigration solutions for corporations, individuals, and families. They have a long history in the field, and they have been proven successful delivering expert immigration counsel, and they focus personal attention on the needs of each client. Brandon, I thank you for being our guest on GlobalRadioTalkShow.com.
Thanks for having me, Ed.
This is Ed Cohen and Global Business News, GlobalRadioTalkShow.com, signing up.
Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful